Okay, I want to spend sufficient time on the Kalam argument, because that's really where the money is in many ways. So let's start to get into this. The Kalam argument was probably originated by a Christian thinker. It was used by Bonaventura later, but interestingly, it was pretty much dropped in the medieval period. Aquinas didn't use it, but the Islamic philosophers used it. And it's been revived in the last 25 or 30 years, principally through the work of William Lane Craig. J.P. Moreland's version is a very fine, carefully tuned argument, but he's relying quite a bit on Bill Craig. And Craig has continued to write on this consistently for 25 years. That's not all he does. The guy is amazing. He writes on everything. But it's been attacked. He's been responding to the attacks. He's been refining it. He's still defending it. And I think it's a powerful argument. Now, this argument attempts to show that the universe had a beginning, and that that beginning was caused, and that beginning was caused by God. So you work with some basic disjuncts. The universe either has a beginning or it doesn't. The argument wants to prove it has a beginning. That beginning was either caused or uncaused. You want to argue that it was caused. That cause was either personal or impersonal. You want to show the cause was personal. Because if it's personal and has the power to create everything out of nothing, that sounds a lot like God. All right? So the first premise is the universe had a beginning. And this argues from the impossibility of the actual infinite. And we have to distinguish the actual infinite from the potential infinite. An actual infinite is limitless, has no restrictions and no limits. So you can't talk about the greatest number, the highest number. There's always one greater. But you can talk about the set of all numbers as being an actual infinite. It's a concept. The question is whether the concept ever is instantiated. Now, a potential infinite is where you have a finite number of things, whatever they may be, that is always increasing. So actually, you get this in Amazing Grace. When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. So that's a potential infinite. You can be there for 10,000 years and have an infinity ahead of you, but it's never a completed set because it keeps extending. Moreover, if you have two points and a line between them, and you talk about the infinite divisibility of the line, that's a potential infinite, because for any point you can have it, you can have it, you can have it, cut it in half, without an end. But it's not an actual infinite. Now, what you want to do is try to show that either the concept of an actual infinite is intrinsically impossible, like a square circle, or show that even though it's possible in a theoretical realm, it can't be instantiated. It cannot, as it were, incarnate in the extramental realm, in the realm of reality. And the way you try to get at this philosophically is to use examples where the actual infinite would apply to space-time situations. Now, the idea itself is pretty difficult even on a theoretical level. But it is employed in set theory, Cantorian set theory. And so people say, since it's employed in set theory, it's at least intelligible. But you have to realize that with an actual infinite, certain subsets can be equal to the whole. Now, that should strike us as counterintuitive, right? Because if you think that a whole is greater than any one of its parts, an actual infinite would violate that. Think of the set of all whole numbers as an actual infinite. Then think of the set of all even numbers. Subtract all the even numbers from the total number, and what do you have? The same actual infinite. Now, does that strike you as odd? Think, what about the library example? You have a library that has an actual infinite number of books, right? How does the rest of it go? Somebody tell me. Yes. Yeah, well, let's take it the red and the blue books. You have an infinite number, and half are red and half are blue. You take away all the blue, you still have an actual infinite. Now, does that strike you as strange or counterintuitive? That you would have a whole and take away half and still have the same amount. See, it seems to be a counterintuitive example. I've already used the one with numbers in terms of all the numbers and the even numbers and so on. Or one of the examples that Moreland gives is from St. Bonaventure. And he's speaking phenomenologically here. He refers to solar revolutions and lunar revolutions. Remember that one? I mean, given a geocentric view, you can just do that for the sake of an example. How many times does the moon go around the Earth for every time the Earth supposedly goes around, or the sun supposedly goes around the Earth? Yeah, it's a 12-to-1 ratio. Now, if you go back, make it an actual infinite, where that situation has always obtained into the infinite past, then it would be the same number. But 12 does not equal 1. So again, that's counterintuitive. It doesn't seem to work. Now, one of the objections here. Actually, let me give you another one from Bill Craig, and Bill's been the master at using this. And he can do it in a very short and simple way. He does it in his debates actually all the time. When he debates an atheist, he always uses the Kalam cosmological argument. This is a book called God, ? A Debate Between a Christian and an Atheist, Bill Craig and Walter Sinnott Armstrong. He starts out, God makes sense of the origin of the universe. Have you ever asked yourself where the universe came from? Why everything exists instead of just nothing? Typically, atheists have said the universe is just eternal and that's all. But surely this is unreasonable. Just think about it a minute. If the universe never had a beginning, this means the number of past events in the history of the universe is infinite. But mathematicians recognize that the existence of an actually infinite number of things leads to self-contradictions. Unless you impose some wholly arbitrary rules to prevent this. For example, what is infinity minus infinity? Well, mathematically, you get some self-contradictory answers. For example, if you subtract all the odd numbers, 1, 3, 5, etc., from all the natural numbers, 0, 1, 2, 3, how many numbers do you have left? An infinite number. So infinity minus infinity is infinity. But suppose instead you subtract all the numbers greater than 2. How many are left? 3. So infinity minus infinity equals 3. It needs to be understood that in both these cases, we have subtracted identical quantities from identical quantities and come up with contradictory answers. In fact, you can get any answer you want from 0 to infinity. So this renders the idea of an instantiated actual infinite as at least highly problematic. And when mathematicians deal with set theory, they don't use addition and subtraction. They can't do that. Those operations are excluded given the nature of this concept that they have created. Now, if the universe is eternal, it is comprised of an actual infinity of states. Right? That's the way it would be. But if there cannot be an actual infinity of states in existence, then it has to have a beginning. It has to be comprised of only a finite collection of states. Now realize the Kalam argument does not trade on any empirical observation, although it can be supplemented by it. Right? Didn't say anything about the redshift or about the second law of thermodynamics. Or anything like that. It's basically a logical argument given the nature of potential and actual infinites. Nor, interestingly, does it require a certain concept of causation. It just has to do with a collection that is actually infinite, however that collection is related. Are you with me on that? See, the Corduan argument is heavily dependent on the idea of causation and dependency. But the Kalam is not. It just has to do with the impossibility of instantiating an actual infinite. That's the first version. The fact that you can deal with infinite sets in mathematics doesn't refute the argument. The question is whether it can be instantiated. Now, there's a second part to it. I'll present this before we take the break. Are you with me on the first part? You have to distinguish the potential from the actual infinite. Then you use some examples to show that the idea of an actual infinite is extremely difficult to support, either in the concept itself or in the instantiation. You're safer in the instantiation because given certain rules, you can work with them in mathematics, or so I'm told. But if you talk about real space-time existence, then we're in a different category. Okay? I mean, think about this. There are mathematical operations that make perfectly good sense that cannot be instantiated, like negative 2, rather. Now, let's say you have three books. I'm just reading this in Book Craig today. Three books on the podium. And then you think of subtracting 5 books. Well, then I have -2 books on the podium. Of course not. That's a mental operation of mathematics. It's self-consistent and makes perfectly good sense. But there's no such thing as a negative book. You see? So there could be this idea of an actual infinite in Cantorian set theory, but it never instantiates. All right, and we've showed some problems with the idea of it existing in terms of an actual infinite of states if the universe never began to exist. But you can refine it. You can say, all right, maybe it could exist as a complete collection all at once, in toto. Maybe. But there's another way to say that it can exist in the universe. What's that? It has to do with sequence. Yeah, the second part of it. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, if the concept makes sense, and it's a little fuzzy to begin with, where a part can equal the whole, even the very concept a priori. Let's say the concept is intelligible, given certain restrictions on the operations of mathematics. Let's just say it could be instantiated all at once. But the universe is not all at once. That is, given the dynamic or A-series view of time. I mean, the universe unfolds over time. So you go from the beginning, if there is a beginning, but just you talk about, you know, T1, T2. It's the idea of temporal development, the arrow of time, if you want to call it that. Now, if things are unfolding, how can you traverse or how can you cross an actual infinite in time? You could say, well, could you count down from infinity? You know, we're getting close. 5, 4. You can't do it. Nor can you go from 0 to infinity. So if the past were an actual infinite, there would never be a present, because we never would have crossed all the states required to get to now. You can't count from, you can't count to infinity, and you can't count back from infinity. So again, it's like jumping out of a bottomless pit. You can't traverse the actual infinite, even if it could exist or be instantiated at all, because you would never get to now. Now, you can add at this point a causal dimension to it, a causal element metaphysically, and talk about present states being causally dependent on previous states, and those being causally dependent on yet previous states. And then you have the problem I talked about earlier, right, with respect to borrowers and getting permission and never getting the money, never getting the permission. Again, it's once again like trying to jump out of a bottomless pit or trying to hang a chandelier on nothing. So the traversing of the actual infinite is highly, highly problematic, whether or not it can exist in reality at all. If it can exist at all, it seems like it would have to exist all at once. But again, the universe does not exist all at once, temporally, given what's called the A-series view of time. You don't have to worry about that too much. But it simply means that temporal progression is real. There are some views of time that some physicists play with where time is all spread out all at once. And it's more like a spatial view of time, where the idea of now does not have a hard designation. It's just relational between this point and this point. But the A-series view, or the dynamic view of time, which I think is the more intuitive and commonsensical view, means that the universe is unfolding state by state by state. And if there's an infinite past, there would be no coming to the present today. But we are now in the present. We have arrived at some point. And so it can't be an infinitely extended past. You might say, but what if we continue to exist forever in the future? What is that? If we began to exist and we continue to exist forever in the future, is that an actual infinite? It's potential, because it never reaches a limit. It never reaches completion, although it continues to increase. And for a potential infinite, you can never take a proper subset and make it equal to the whole. With an actual infinite, you could do that with the even numbers and all the numbers, or the odd numbers and all the numbers. Remember that earlier example? Or with the books. Yes? You don't want the argument to make the existence of God impossible. That'd be a very bad argument. Let me just give you the basic structure of the answer, because we'll come back to it. There are two parts to the question. One is, well, don't we talk about God as being infinite himself? But we're not talking about a quantitative sequence. We're talking about qualitative perfection. So God is infinite in his knowledge and power and wisdom. So to use Anselmian terms, God is the greatest conceivable being in every dimension of value. So God possesses every attribute that is better to have than to lack, and he possesses it to the maximal degree. So for shorthand, we might say God is infinitely good, infinitely powerful, infinitely knowledgeable. But that's more of a qualitative understanding. Where it gets a little tricky, though, is when you talk about infinitely knowledgeable. Because if God knows all true propositions and the future extends infinitely into the future, then God has an actual infinite knowledge of all true propositions. But see, that's not an instantiated situation, though. That's not a space-time, real-life particularity. That's God's knowledge. So I tend to think that the actual infinite is a part of God's mind with respect to his knowledge of all true propositions. But that's not the same as an instantiation. Now, the other thing, we'll come back to it after the break. I know you all need a break. I need one too at this point, is the relationship of God and time. Because look, if God is in time, in the same way that we are in time, and you use the idea that an actual infinite cannot be instantiated in a linear sequence, then so much for God. Because God could not even exist as an actual infinite in reality, in his being, if it's impossible. Okay? Now, just briefly, let me tell you that it's only been in the last 3 years that I've accepted the Kalam cosmological argument. I've been a Christian for a long time, and I've known about the argument for at least 20 years. I used to reject it because I used to think that that was the conclusion. Because I don't believe that God is atemporal. Now, J.P. Moreland clearly says God is atemporal, or timeless, or you might say eternal. So God is not subject to temporality whatsoever. Probably for about the last 15 years, I haven't believed that. So I think that God is in some sense temporal. I'll tell you why after the break. It might cause some of you to come back who wouldn't otherwise. I think God is in some sense temporal. But is God temporal in a sense that subjects him to the argument about the impossibility of the actual infinite? I don't think so. So we have to get into the metaphysics of time with respect to God, and the metaphysics of time with respect to God's creation. And there are three basic alternatives you can take there, two of which allow you to use the Kalam argument, one of which does not. Okay, so we've talked about the problem of an actual infinite. Let me give you another example. This is one that Bill Craig likes to use. It's called Hilbert's Hotel. This is from a new book by Paul Copan and Bill Craig called Creation Out of Nothing, Biblical, Philosophical, and Scientific Exploration. The chapter called Philosophical Arguments for Creatio Ex Nihilo. Perhaps the best way to support this premise is by way of thought experiments that illustrate the various absurdities that would result if an actual infinite were to be instantiated in the real world. So it's a reductio ad absurdum argument. An example is the famous Hilbert's Hotel, a product of the mind of the great German mathematician David Hilbert. Let us first imagine a hotel with a finite number of rooms. Suppose, furthermore, that all the rooms are full. When a new guest arrives asking for a room, the proprietor apologizes, "Sorry, all the rooms are full," and the new guest is turned away. Now, let us imagine a hotel with an infinite number of rooms, and suppose once more that all the rooms are full. There's not a single vacant room throughout the entire infinite hotel. Now imagine a new guest shows up asking for a room. "But of course," says the proprietor, and he immediately shifts the person in room 1 to room 2, the person in room 2 to room 3, the person in room 3 to room 4, and so on out to infinity. As a result of these room changes, room 1 now becomes vacant, so the new guest gratefully checks in. But remember, before he arrived, all the rooms were full. Equally curious, according to the mathematicians, there are now no more persons in the hotel than there were before. The number is just infinite. But how can this be? The proprietor just added the new guest's name to the register and gave him his keys. How can there not be one more person in the hotel than before? He gives an even stranger variation on Hilbert's Hotel. Suppose an infinity of new guests show up at the desk, each asking for a room. Of course," says the proprietor, and he proceeds to shift the person in room 1 into room 2, the person in room 2 into room 4, person in room 3 into room 6, and so on, out to infinity, always putting each occupant into the room numbered twice his previous room's number. Because any natural number multiplied by 2 always equals an even number, all the guests wind up in even-numbered rooms. As a result, all the odd-numbered rooms become vacant, and the infinity of new guests is easily accommodated. And yet, before they came, all the rooms were full. And again, strangely enough, the number of guests in the hotel is the same after the infinity of new guests check in as before, even though there were as many new guests as old guests. In fact, the proprietor could repeat this process infinitely many times. And yet there would never be one single person in the hotel than before. And he gives another weird result. I'll leave that one to your own research. Is this starting to make sense? Yes.
I was thinking of something over break, and I'd like you to address it. Before when we had a limited knowledge of the laws of physics, before we understood the law of gravity, people rationalized that the Earth was flat because if it was circular, they would fall off the bottom. In the same way, can't we say that we, in our understanding of math, our math knowledge may be limited, and it could very well be possible? Mm-hmm. I don't want to put God in any kind of way because of our understanding may be lacking.
Well, sure, again, these arguments are defeasible. If you can defeat the counterexamples, or if you say, look, if we can do it mathematically, it could exist in the real world, then you've given a good argument. But again, I'm no master of set theory or theoretical mathematics. I really rely on people like JP and Bill Craig on this. But from what they say, that set theory is quite well developed, and the idea of an actual infinite has been worked out pretty thoroughly, and not just recently. But when you apply it to the real world, it produces these absurdities. So like any philosophical argument, it's open to counterexample and counterargument. Then you just wait for the argument. And there's been plenty of discussion back and forth on this particular argument in the last 20, 25 years, especially in the philosophical literature. Yes? Well, we'll actually come back to that. I need to talk a little bit about the scientific confirmation that the beginning was caused and caused by God. But I just wanted to anticipate a concern, and that is if God ends up part of a infinite series of events, then were this argument's in deep yogurt. Because we're saying that an infinite series of events cannot occur because an actual infinite cannot be instantiated because it generates these absurdities. So you have three basic options, just to telegraph it a little bit once again. Say that God is entirely outside of time, tenseless, timeless. Before, during, and after does not apply to the being of God. And that has been pretty much the traditional received notion in the history of theology. You can do what Bill Craig does, which is say that without creation, sans creation, God is timeless. With creation, God is in time. Because creation was required for time, for the necessary and sufficient conditions for time to occur. So God, and you have to put this very carefully because otherwise it sounds very paradoxical. You say God before the creation was timeless and after the creation was in time. It doesn't sound very good because it presupposes temporal duration. You say God without creation is timeless. God with creation, God enters time. He enters into the space-time matrix. Or you can say, actually there are four possibilities. Or you can say God is a temporal being, but the sort of temporal being that is not subject to the actual infinite problem. That is, God is a being who exists in what you might call pure duration before the creation of the world. And you can say before without fudging it. But since there were no objects, physical objects, and no natural laws before the creation, there was no clock time. There were no seconds and minutes ticking off. So you don't accumulate the problem of the actual infinite. Or you can say that God has always existed in a linear series of discrete events. And then you have to throw out the Kalam argument, otherwise God cannot exist. Those are the competitors. Now, I used to be in the fourth category. I used to think that God existed in a temporal sequence of events from eternity. So there must be some way out of this actual infinite problem if God can do it. See? And I had other reasons for believing in God besides the Kalam. In fact, you've got the Big Bang, whether the Kalam works or not. You have Big Bang cosmology. You have the Thomistic argument. You have the Leibnizian argument. You have moral argument. Design. Lots of good arguments for God, even if the Kalam goes belly up. But what happened is recently, in the last couple of years, Bill Craig came to Denver, came to this region. We had him come in to give a talk here, And as I was driving him to the airport, you know, this is Mr. Kalam Cosmological Argument, and I'm just Mr. Peanut talking to him and saying, Bill, you know, I know you've done more work on this than anybody on the planet, but I still can't buy God as timeless. I can't buy your construal of God and time. He said, you don't have to. I went, what? He said, there's a view of God and time held by Alan Paget and Richard Swinburne where God is considered a temporal being in one sense, but God's life is not divisible into an actual infinite of moments. You can hold that view and still hold the Kalam argument. And I thought, goodness, I didn't know about that view. So a book came out not long after that called God and Time, Four Views. And I read the entry by Alan Paget. And I realized that was pretty much what I had been saying for years. But he said it better than I did. And I called him up and I said, Alan, is your view compatible with the Kalam cosmological argument? He said it is. So I converted. So for the last 3 years, I have to teach through this hard stuff. Whereas before I said, well, it's a fascinating argument. Lots of smart people believe it. But if God's in time, it doesn't work. The last 3 years, I've been teaching it because I think God can be in time and not be subject to this actual infinite problem. Now, you might be thinking, since I telegraphed it, you better keep going. Why think that God's in time at all? All right? Well, one of the most basic reasons is that God is a personal being. And it's very hard to imagine a tenseless person who doesn't change whatsoever, who is a person who relates to other persons, who relates within himself inter-Trinitarianly, and who relates to beings who live in a world of change. Just think of yourself before you existed, or you're not yourself. Think of a state before you existed, when you existed as an unforgiven person, and you existed as a forgiven person in Christ. God would relate to each state differently. Before you exist, he knows you're going to exist, but there's no one to relate to. I think God knew that at that time. You come into existence, you're a sinner, you need redemption. God knows that, but you're not yet redeemed. Time T2. When you convert, time T3, you are now accepted by God through the work of Christ, the finished work of Christ. God's orientation to you changes. How can God do all that if God himself is timeless and completely apart from any change whatsoever? Now, I don't believe for a minute that God changes his character or changes his plan for the universe. By no means. God does not change in the integrity of his character. He doesn't lose or gain his essential attributes by any means. But I think if God is a personal relational being, it makes more sense to view God as in some sense a part of the temporal world as opposed to being timeless. Or you might say atemporal or a tenseless being. Those are my basic reasons. And that's why I didn't accept the Kalam for many years. Yes?
How would the Kalam argument be with open theism?
Well, an open theist might accept it. But they have a different view of maybe human agency, a different view of the possibility of middle knowledge. I mean, the Kalam is really neutral with respect to whether or not you're going to be an open theist. An open theist could use the argument for God's existence, but they would change the concept of God in relation to the classical view because of the problem of evil, because of their view of the nature of human freedom, and so on.